Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille, and
This is Roberto Maria Atti.
With you at the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial. Always bringing you something a little different. A little surprise for you, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Hey, listen, we're here today to talk to you about pain. Pain, pain management, pain, the whole idea of pain, pain in your life. Do you have any pain in your life? You know, younger you are, the less there is. The older you are, the more there is.
That's what they say.
Try that again.
I said, that's what they say.
That's what they say. There's some information about pain that you would want to know that you probably have no idea about, and especially if you're ever taking care of anyone who's in pain, you know, if you have anybody you have to attend to, there are facts you should know about pain. So we've put a bunch of things together about physical pain primarily today, and to understand pain. I mean, the many different types of pain. How many types of pain are there, you know? If you think about the human body, how many different ways can you feel pain itself? For those of you who feel pain, I mean, there are some people who feel no pain at all.
It seems endless. It seems like we have an endless capacity to feel any number of kinds of pain. And in the end, it's all nerve pain, because in order to feel the pain, you need to have a nervous system. Without nerves, there's no pain. And in fact, the brain itself feels no pain whatsoever. Did you know that? The brain itself, if you put a knife into it, or if you slice off a piece of it, the brain itself does not feel any pain, but the nerves do.
There are many types of pain. Many types of pain, nerve pain being the one. But, you know, even though everything comes out to be a nerve pain, the source behind the nerve pain is what's important as well. For example, there is muscle pain. Now, muscle pain, you've all had it. You've worked out. You've had muscle pain. But then there's cramps. Isn't a cramp a muscle pain as well?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so there are cramps. There are muscle pains. They could be murderous, right? Let's think about some of the worst pains there are. Just because what are we going to do here on a Wednesday?
How about neuralgia, which is an inflammation of the nerves, and it can happen on the face, it can happen on the skin, anywhere in the body, it can happen in the bones, and it's we call it nerve pain.
Yeah, okay, and there's bone pain.
Tooth pain.
Well, let's think about bone pain for a minute. How do you get bone pain? What's bone feel like? What does bone pain feel like?
Well, it could feel like someone is carving your bones from the inside. That's how it has been described.
That's the way they describe it.
Who feel it.
And what kind of people feel bone pain?
Rheumatism is very painful. Cancer can hit the bones, and it can be excruciatingly painful. Leukemia can cause bone pain. Osteoporosis, of course.
You know, you talk about tooth pain before. Think about pains that you've had in your life. A pain in your tooth. One would think you have a pain in your tooth, you go rub something on it, that'll take care of the pain, you know. But when you're a baby and you start teething, that pain is really difficult. But worse than that, there are cultures that never had tooth pain.
Well, yes, they didn't before they were familiarized with the modern diet, which is known to cause cavities. And for instance, the Eskimos, before they started to eat refined sugar and all the foods that are in the modern diet, they didn't know what a cavity was. After that, they started to develop all kinds of problems with their teeth. And because they didn't have dentists, I have read that some of them committed suicide from feeling from a toothache.
It is excruciating. I mean, a bad tooth pain, as many of you know and have gone through, could be one of the worst pains you'll ever feel. It's so terrible. And, you know, hopefully you get it resolved, but you can't get to your dentist. you take some kind of aspirin, some kind of pill to do away with it. But because it's so closely related to the nervous system, and the nerves are so closely related, the pain seems to be more intense and more direct. Another kind of pain besides tooth pain, one of the worst, what do you think is the worst of all pains? I think burn, you know, Roberta, is...
Burn pain is rated up there as one of the worst possible. Yes, when the burns are extensive and deep, because it doesn't quit. And that's something else that I was going to say, that it also, when pain lasts a long time, it is made worse by the anxiety that it causes.
We'll get to that. Pain... type of pain, abdominal pain. Burns, of course, are really bad because, you know, a funny thing about it, if you have a burn, the main thing you want to do is keep air off it because the air is what's murderous. You know, in the early days, they used to have, I remember a young man who was burned all over his body as a child, and they didn't have the bandages that were non-stick bandages, so they put bandages on your burns to keep the oxygen out, to keep the air away from it, and then they'd peel away the bandages, and of course the flesh would come with it, and it would be exposed to the air all over again. Nowadays, luckily, we've invented bandages that are non-stick. They have some Teflon on them.
Well, and the idea is also to keep the burned part in cold water because that protects it from oxygen and numbs the pain.
Abdominal pain is another form of pain. If you get a stomach ache that's so bad you could die, that you ever feel like you just grab your stomach and you fall over, and there are forms of stomach pain that you could get, and many of them are include gas, which is terrible.
That's the pressure that causes pain, and that's really painful because the bowel cannot expand beyond a certain point. So if it's stretched beyond the limit, let's say, then that's what hurts.
An amazing thing, a trick that someone I remember at a camp once taught us, that if you're feeling pain in your stomach and you think it may be gas, because, you know, part of what Roberta referred to is the anxiety related to disorders. One of the worst things is, you know, with pain is it going to get worse? Is this a signal? Well, gas is kind of an interesting thing. When you get a pain in your stomach, if you kneel on your elbows and your knees, and if it's a gas pain, somehow that works. If it's gas pain, it relieves the gas pain. And if it's not gas pain, it won't be relieved, and it's something else. That was one of the diagnostic tools.
There is a yoga position called wind relieving pain, which is kind of a funny name, but it explains how it works.
I imagine what it looks like.
And it's exactly what you described.
You know, it's got you so that boom, air could come out of you if it needs to.
Right.
Childbirth. I mean, how do we talk about childbirth as a pain since it's so excruciating?
Right. And it's also, again, the longer it lasts, the more it wears a person down, a woman down, so that the length of the pain experience really means a lot in terms of the intensity, because the longer we feel the pain, the more powerless, usually, we feel to control it, and so the more anxiety we experience, and the worse that makes the pain.
One of the great difficulties is being able to describe a pain to a physician. You go to the physician, and he says, well, what kind of pain is it? Is it a pressure pain? Is it a sharp pain? Is it a nerve pain? You know, in learning to identify and express what you're feeling is very important, because the physician who's trying to help you, or anybody health practitioner who's trying to help you, they want to get an idea from you, and they can't tell.
Well, and also I think physicians are really trained not to believe in the intensity of pain, because there's a belief that people try to get medicines for pain, you know, as a recreational substance. And so a lot of physicians are reluctant to believe that someone is in pain. And it's almost an interrogation to try to describe the pain accurately and effectively enough that the physician will believe you. I'm sure all of you have had some experience like that, where you feel like you're not being believed. And yet it seems that only very few people, a very, very small minority of people, ever become addicted to these substances, so that the risk of the addiction is minimal, whereas we now know that it's really best to medicate the pain early on rather than to let it go on for too long, because the longer it goes on, the worse it gets.
Well, that's part of the research that was just unearthed. That was kind of interesting. You know, I mean, if you're a naturalist and you're somebody who doesn't believe in taking a pain-relieving substance, you know, and you say, look, I'd rather do without pain, I'd rather do without the aspirin, I'd rather do without it, many of you have found ways of successfully fighting your off your pain. There is some recent research that indicates, however, that toughing it out is not a good idea. Now, this is a very difficult concept because, you know, if you think about the fact that you really don't want to take any of these pain-killing substances, which are, you know, going to wreak havoc on your immune system and your body, yet you're suffering from a kind of an intolerable physical pain, you're really tossed in the middle there. Now, what was this research that we just saw, Roberta, about whether to medicate or not medicate pain if it's chronic pain?
Well, what the research shows is that the body learns to expect the pain, and the body becomes almost, as a way to protect itself from it, it creates pain. It's a paradox, but this is one of the many paradoxes that the body remedies that the body will create for itself. It shows that when people believe that they are going to be in pain, or if they believe that the pain they're in is going to last a long time, this belief makes the pain more intense, longer, or it even brings on pain. So that if at the onset, let's say menstrual cramps, which are known to begin at a low level of intensity and increase as time goes on, if the person medicates the pain in the very early stages when it's not too intense, usually it goes away with a very small amount of an anti-inflammatory.
One Midol.
Yes, one Advil, 200 milligrams of Motrin. But if the person says, no, I'm going to tough it out, and they wait and it increases, then it gets to a point where you need to take something strong, much stronger, much more so than if you had taken care of it at the beginning. It doesn't go away, it gets more intense, so it's actually best to medicate it early on. It requires much less painkiller.
But we've heard for years, Roberta, you know, from some of the natural healing programs, and I mean, you're a natural healer, you know. We've heard you got to avoid those things at all costs.
Well, I used to believe that because, you know, of course, because you always want to go natural. But I now have changed my perception and my view of it because I've seen too many people suffer needlessly in the name of, you know, naturalism and not achieve the results that they were hoping for, meaning that the pain doesn't go away, it gets worse, and then eventually they get to a point where it needs stronger medications. And yes, the mind can be taught to deal with pain without medication, that's true. But it's not something that happens overnight, and it's not something that happens when we are in pain.
Well, there's an interesting thing about it. I mean, what the research indicates suggests, and it's not research done by physicians as I am, or drug companies, but it suggests that, just as Roberta's saying, if you let it last, it builds up its own kind of pain system. That if you have pain and you don't cut it off at the pass, it gets worse and worse and worse, and then it sets up a kind of a pattern of pain, so that as soon as that pain begins again, it's already going to go to the worst level. It's going to go. Let's say you have a level one menstrual cramp, and you take some kind of medication for it, or even herbal remedies, and that takes care of it. That's great. If you tough it out and it goes to eight,
then you need to take something stronger.
But then let's say you never take anything at all and you get through it after number 8. You get exhausted. Well, then what it's going to do is it's going to say every time we got to go from 1 to 8.
Right.
See, the problem is you set up a pattern. Now, we're going to describe how this happens. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about physical pain and some of the recent research about physical pain. There are things that people think that are true and are not true. Here's a myth about it. Are women less tolerant of pain, do you think, than men are? You know, do you think that women feel, do you think women are sissies? You know, that's the idea. Is that the way it works? Well, the research indicates that women have a lower tolerance, a lower threshold for pain initially. But they also, when pain continues for a long period of time, they have a higher tolerance. So women in prolonged pain do better than men in prolonged pain, but women initially have a greater difficulty. And that's kind of easy to understand with the sensitivity levels, receptivity, everything else. But a woman is, why do you think a woman is able to tolerate chronic pain so much better than men can?
Childbirth, I think, is the answer, meaning that a woman's body is able to deal with prolonged pain because in childbirth, that's what needs to happen. The woman needs to have some kind of a functioning pain system whereby when it intensifies, she adapts to it and is able to secrete endorphins and other neurotransmitters to cope with it, because that's what's needed in labor and childbirth. But acute pain, intense, short-lived pain, I think men, because of their history of being hunters, have a tolerance for it better than women, because when you're hunting, if you get injured, you need to be able to not feel it so that you can continue with the hunt.
Shut it off right away.
Shut
you
it off
feel
right
it,
away.
You got a big wince in you.
And a lot of...
you give it the Rambo treatment.
Right. And a lot of that is really made possible by the stress hormones that are secreted during stressful times.
Anxiety about pain is a very interesting thing, because why would you be anxious about pain? There are two parts of the anxiety, right? One part is you wonder if it's going to get worse. So along with pain, any physical pain you have, you wonder, is this going to get worse? Now that anxiety adds to the pain because you're anticipating a worse level of pain.
And that's kind of like the paradox that I was describing. Here is how it goes. At least if the body, let's say that the body fears that the pain is going to get worse, what it does is it tries to take control by making it worse so that at least it's in control of it. And it makes it bad enough that it, but at least it feels like it's in control of it. So the expectation of it is often what makes it get to that point as a protective strategy, which is a paradox, but if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
It might be that there's a threshold at which there's a secretion of endorphins and there's a threshold under which you don't have it.
Right.
So if you have a mild pain, you don't feel it very much. If you have a mild pain, did you ever feel anything hurt and then you hurt it more, like you have something in your body that hurts and then you lean on it and it brings you a sharper pain? You know, sometimes people do that to themselves. They create a sharper pain in themselves.
Mm.
And why would you do it? Like, let's say you have a hangnail. You know, hangnail pain. Ooh, it could be kind of brutal, but it's not there. It's there and it's not there. It's intermittent nervous pain. And some people will take that and manipulate the hangnail purposely to create the bigger pain.
Well, because it numbs when the threshold is reached. Yes, there is endorphins and other neurotransmitters that are secreted that create a numbing effect, so that if you intensify the pain enough to reach that threshold, you go numb.
And
so
these are things that are unconscious in the human body. Now, the amazing thing about this, friends, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti doing The Positive Mind. How does this relate to the mind? the way it relates to the mind is interesting, too. Did you ever get in a relationship with somebody where it just, you know, it's just mildly bad, so what you want to do is make it worse? So you can get to a point where you have a big fight and a blowout, and then it gets better, where you can't stand mild levels of discomfort in relationships. And you'll see that all of the stuff we're talking about related to the human body also relates to the way the mind functions.
Sure.
Let's take on this issue of catastrophic pain. Talk about that, Roberta.
Well, let's say if a child grows up in a home environment where he or she witnesses violence, abuse, unhappiness, and tragedies, the child's nervous system grows to expect these things. Well, first of all, it grows to adapt to the continuous stressors, but then eventually it grows with an expectation, becoming adapted to the expectation that this is how life is. Therefore, once this child becomes an adult, the nervous system will look for situations that maintain the same level of intensity and the same level of discomfort and unhappiness that the nervous system has become habituated to. This is kind of another paradox, but if you think about it, it makes sense. So the person seems to live in a catastrophe, in a tragedy, and all the time is suffering. And when you talk to them, it seems like they almost look for this suffering in their lives, and they can't live without it. And that can be mind-boggling, to say the least. And yet, if you see how this develops, it makes a lot of sense.
And it makes a lot of sense not just from a psychological point of view. From a physiological point of view, it makes sense.
Sure.
You know that a person with catastrophic pain has it all set up for catastrophic pain, and they have their life set up for catastrophe.
And I think that the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, really showed how cells develop receptors for neurotransmitters, and the neurotransmitters, which are the substances secreted by the nervous system in any given situation, if the person is used to being in pain, then those receptors are going to be the pain receptors, and they're going to expect to be fed with the pain related neurotransmitters. And if nothing is coming, meaning if you're not in pain, the receptors are kind of hungry, and the person feels like their life is empty or something, because there's no stimulus.
There are certain that, and the emptiness is the absence of pain. Ask somebody how they feel. And if you ask somebody what they feel, one of the signs that we see is if you ask a person what they feel, they tell you what they're feeling. You say, what are you feeling right now? And they'll give you a general feeling. But then you ask, what are you really feeling? Tell me what you're feeling. People always report their feelings as the absence of pain. Well, I don't feel any pain in my shoulder. Well, I don't feel anything in my stomach. They can't report the presence of a pleasant feeling because they're not trained that way.
Mm-hmm.
People are trained to define themselves, to actually create who they are by their pain levels.
Yes, that's very true. It becomes an identifying strategy, meaning I can identify myself through my pain, and then when I'm asked who I am or what I'm about, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
And so this is the way it works. Now, we have another part of this, and we're going to take your calls a little later. That's very fascinating.
I wanted to say something about the interoception.
Oh, that's exactly where I was going to go.
Oh.
I was going to go there next. I was going to say we're going to take
first.
The calls. Well, you know, I was thinking we'll do that after the break.
Okay.
Because there's something that is very important about pain and the way that we function with our pain systems inside. You get to reinterpret things like pain addiction. You know, it kind of makes sense. If you're used to always producing a high level of it, this is a catastrophic thing. If you're always used to going to some high level of pain, there's going to be a part of you that's yearning for it as part of your identity. This is what I said about the definition of people by their pain levels. How do you, my friend, define yourself? Think about how you talk about what you feel. How do you feel? I feel. Do you ever think of saying, I feel really calm in my stomach because it feels good inside there? Oh, I love the sound of my regular heartbeat. You know, oh, my hands feel really nicely warm. Does anyone ever talk like that? No. But, oh, my wrist is killing me, my back hurts, you know. That's what they'll talk in terms of. One of the things we found is if you train people to talk in terms of the positive sensations they feel, it decreases the identity of themselves as a pain-functioning organism.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you are. You're only your pain or the absence of your pain.
Right.
So imagine right now, friends, where you're sitting. How do your eyes feel? You know, think about your eyes. Well, I don't feel anything in my eyes, right? Well, think about it a little more. How are your eyes feeling? How are your eyes feeling, Roberta?
They feel fantastic.
How fantastic?
How fantastic?
Yeah.
They feel really, really good. I'm seeing things I like to see, and I'm enjoying seeing them.
Uh-huh. What about the lubrication in your eyes?
It's good. It's adequate. Right?
But you're right.
You're right that I normally don't think about this unless my eyes hurt.
You want a pleasure sensation? Breathe air through your nostrils. Now, that's actually a pleasure sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do we ever describe that? Oh, I like the way the air feels going in and out of my nose.
You're making a good point, Armand.
You know, do we ever describe it as that way?
Life is such a pleasure if we only paid attention to it, isn't it?
You know, and you know another thing that's really wonderful? A clean scalp. When you, no, it really is. You know when you wash your hair?
When it doesn't itch.
What? When you wash your hair, you've got nothing on there. There's this experience.
It's true.
Of an absolutely clean scalp. Do you think anybody ever, how are you feeling? Oh, my scalp feels terrific.
You know what I'm thinking? My bones. I love my bones. They support me. They feel strong. They feel, you know, like good for the job. But I don't think about my bones because they're always there. And yet, if I think about them, how wonderful they are.
How great they are, right?
How
what
great
a nice
they
job
are.
They're doing.
Yeah.
I watched a program the other day on lubricants around the world. And these are these. I don't know why I watch programs on lubricants. It talked about lubricants. It talked about a grease that they use on engines. And it talked about, you know, how important it is to have proper lubricants. In your body, my friends, lubrication is essential for life. That's what keeps the cells moving. You know
sure.
what I mean? I mean, if we ever celebrated our lubricants, you know what I mean?
What a good idea.
It's a great idea because when you get dehydrated and you start losing some of that lubrication, you could really feel it.
And in fact, people badmouth mucus. Mucus is
bad-mouth.
Great. Mucus is.
People badmouth phlegm.
Yeah, they think it's a bad thing. It's actually a great thing. Thank God for mucus.
Hey, this is Armand DeMille and Roberta Mariotti. We're starting to get there. We're going to take a short break, and when we be back, play a little music, and then we'll be right back with you.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Boy, that's a little active, isn't it?
Yeah, nice.
Bossa Cuca Nova is what it's called. You know, that dancing has got to be good for the pain in your body.
It definitely is. Actually, that's what research shows, that dancing and exercise both are very good for pain relief, but only if you enjoy them, not if you impose them upon yourself as a must-do. Only if you love doing that.
Imagine a must-do dance.
Well,
I mean, do you imagine I must dance.
Okay. Well, some aerobic dancing is like that. You do it as a form of exercise, and you don't do it because you enjoy it. You do it because you think it's good for you. But in this sense, it's good if you like it, if it gives you a good feeling, then it's good.
In the countries where there is the least amount of medication for pain available, there is the highest amount of dancing. Right? So you see it in the Caribbean a lot. You'll see there'll be Mardi Gras.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in Brazil they'll be dancing all the time, dancing through the streets. You do that samba, and the samba is such a motion of the body. I mean, it's like an aerobic walk. Your legs and your arms are going the whole way. And it's like you're kind of moving to this.
But see, it's not the movement itself as much as the pleasure of moving that has a positive effect on everything, not just pain relief, everything, the immune system, the digestive system. Everything benefits from pleasurable movement of the body.
Pleasurable movement of the body seems to be the key thing to do.
Yep.
Dan, so let's talk about this. This is really fascinating, friend. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Achi. Roberta, you know, is Brazilian.
Absolutely, with every bone in my body. You know, actually, I wanted to say something about what you said a while ago with identifying with the pain. You know what I've discovered, and this is my theory, Armand, that when we lose someone we love, a person, even a pet, I mean, someone that has become such a part of our lives that we don't want to live without them, I've noticed that there's a kind of pain that can be physical and or emotional that is related to the grief. And sometimes we recycle that because it's the only thing we have left of that person or of that creature that we miss. So that we call it back, the pain, so that we have a sensation that reminds us of that person.
So isn't that interesting that grieving in itself could be an attempt to reconnect through pain?
Sure. Well, I believe that that's exactly what it is, because that's what it feels like.
One would imagine that you grieve through pleasant memories, you know? Oh, I remember my mom, and I remember, you know, and you think about the pleasant memories you had with your mom. And that might be very nice if your mom had died. Could be nice if the pleasant memories, but the grief and the pain that goes with it every time you think about it is the connection.
Yeah, and it allows you to keep the person alive, at least in your perception, because if you perceive the pain of their missing, not being there, in a way they're still there.
And the other part of it is, you know, strangely enough, a smile doesn't give you all that much sensation. But, you know, a little grief, a heartache, gives you plenty.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, that's the other thing, the catharsis. I mean, in ancient Greece, people would go to the theater to watch a tragedy whereby they would cry for hours watching the unfolding disasters on stage. And that would get them to a place where they would suffer so much, they would release all this pain, emotional, but I think physical too, because where's the boundary, really? I mean, it's kind of blurry. They would release all this pain and then go home and feel good.
Hmm. This is Armand DeMille with you, with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to talk about interoception.
Mm.
Interoception, a very common... This is going to be an interesting concept that I want you to try this on. Try to think of who runs the trains in a subway system, an extensive subway system, or in any train system. And I want to talk about a train air traffic controller or a train controller, a train master. Because we're going to talk about the human brain as the brain being a spot that will listen. It's like a computer that is listening to signals it gets all the time from the different tracks. The tracks are the nerves going to different parts of your body. The nerve that goes all the way down to your feet could be your sciatic nerve. It could be another nerve, and it could be, you know, nerves that go to your shoulders, nerves that go to your fingertips, nerves that go to your teeth. Your body is filled with bunches of nerves, right? How many nerves do you think there are in the human body? Did anybody ever figure it out?
Imagine
if you took all the nerves and put them end to end. How far they would go, they would probably go to Brooklyn.
At least.
Okay, so you have all these nerves in your body, and the nerve is the signal carrier.
Actually, the nerve is, yes, the carrier. And then you have the train, which is the signal.
Right. So you have this telephone wire going to your brain in the form of a nerve, right? And it's all the way, this nerve could be in your toe, or it could be in your ear, but it's going to send a signal, how are we doing? And everywhere you go, like an air traffic controller, you want to know what's the condition of every part of the body. And the brain, the master controller, is monitoring, get this, every part of your body. Every inch of your stomach, every inch of your heart has nerves that are being sent, signals of which are being sent to an unconscious, meaning it's not wide awake part of your brain, but a brain that's like a computer saying, is everything normal? Is everything normal? Is everything normal?
Right, and it has to be unconscious, because if it weren't, the number of signals reaching the brain at any given moment is in the millions. Millions, not billions.
Just think about one fingernail.
Millions,
you know, if my right fingernail on my right hand, if my pinky nail sends a signal, well, my next finger sends a signal.
But that's why
there's the upside, the downside, there's the coolness of it, the temperature of it, the heat of it, the cramp of it.
The circulation
of the blood.
Blood and lymph and other things. There is the
pressure.
Entrance and exit of bacteria and other microorganisms that the immune system needs to pay attention to, and that also is in the brain. I mean, it's all...
Billions of, billions, he called it once, of signals.
Yes. And
going to the brain, and they're being ignored. So think about train again. You're the train master. You're asleep. You know, you could be asleep. You need your rest. You're tired. You worked hard. And you just assume that the computers are working properly. Every now and then, a computer's going to give off a beep.
Right. Every now and then, there's going to be a signal from the stomach, from the toe, from the finger, from the ear, that something needs you to wake up and pay attention to it. And that's when, in fact, maybe there is a little pain, or maybe there is a wind, like a cold draft, or maybe there's something that needs... Or when you're hungry, the brain says, hey, it's time to eat. When a signal is allowed to pass into the awareness threshold, then the brain makes you aware of it, because you need to take action and do something about whatever that signal is saying to you. And so for most of us, let's say that maybe 5% of what goes on in the body at any given moment, it comes into the awareness. For instance, right now I'm aware that I'm sitting down. I'm aware that the light is on. I'm aware that I am wearing a set of headphones. But I'm not aware of what my stomach is doing or what my liver is doing, for instance. So that's the way it should be.
But the master controller is aware of it. You
yes,
know, Roberta, it's saying, okay, you know, and this is all going normal. This is all going normal. If you suddenly had a hunger pang, or if you ate something that disagreed with you, if you got a gas pang, in the middle of what you're doing, it would send you a signal, and you'd suddenly be aware of some part of your body.
Because the brain is letting me know that I need to take action. I need to do something to fix a potential disturbance or problem.
You may need to do something. It doesn't say you have to. It wakes up and it goes, oops, what's over there? Oh, there's a signal now. Now, there's a part of her that may not be, what is that? And then the brain wakes to a semi-conscious level of paying attention to distress signals.
Right.
And if there are more than one distress signal, you know, then it really wakes up the whole way. If it's one distress signal that it could handle by changing the, you know, let's change the CD. The music has run out. So we're going to change it. You know, you could do it practically unconsciously.
Right.
You change the music unconsciously. You could do something unconscious. It takes care of it. The brain sends a signal out. You need some digestive juices. Let's say you've eaten something and you have a little acidic stomach. And a signal goes up to your brain, and your brain gets an alert, right? But it's a green alert. It's nothing.
Right. There's not much that needs
to be done. So the brain says, okay, pituitary, send out some fluids.
Right.
Right? And you send down some hormones, and you go to your stomach, and you go enzymes or whatever it is that you need.
But you don't need to be aware of all this. The brain does it without much input from the consciousness.
Now, let's say that you had a stomach upset and the enzymes didn't work, right? The brain works and said, well, that didn't work. Let's go to stage two.
So the brain then would intensify that signal, would make the discomfort more intense so that you might, for instance, get up and get yourself a hot lemonade and drink a hot lemonade and take care of the stomach upset or something like that.
It gets you to do something by intensifying the signal. This is very important.
Right, right. So the more intense the signal, the more aware you're going to be of what's going on and the more likely you are to take action. And so what has been found is that for depressed people, that threshold is much lower than for normal people. What I mean by that is that all of those signals from the intestines, from the liver, from the heart, from the blood vessels, from the bones, from the muscles, that are normally not perceived, they don't need to be perceived, they should not be perceived. Depressed people perceive them because they don't have that protective barrier that allows the brain to do its job silently and without the person being aware of it. So for a depressed person, for instance, their digestive system is not functioning on its own. It's constantly sending signals that are alarming. Why are they alarming? Even if they're not painful, they are alarming for the simple reason that they should not be felt. Period. There should not be any signal being sent to the brain, but because the gut signals, for instance, a peristaltic movement, the person feels something they should not be feeling, and this increased awareness of their bodily functions creates anxiety.
So you have this thing, and I think we're listening to something very important that we've learned about depression. Why depression is more of a problem than we would think it is. You know, I mean, so you're depressed, so you go through life, so what? You know what I mean? Some people feel bad and other people don't feel bad. It's your right to be depressed. But you see, depression has this incredible work on the body. And this research that we're finding about the interoception brain signal barriers is the air traffic controller with depressed people is awake all the time.
Right.
He's awake because he's feeling all of this stuff is coming up and there is no barrier that says it's normal.
Right.
So it's all the way up there. So now you have an air traffic controller who doesn't sleep. And yes, just as you thought, people who are depressed are usually insomniacs as well. They have a trouble either oversleeping or undersleeping.
80% of depressed people suffer from insomnia, which means they don't sleep enough.
And why do they have insomnia? Because their mind is going a mile a minute interpreting the pain.
There's too much input from the body, too much signals going up.
Is there little wonder that a depressed person will then become obsessive compulsive?
hypochondriac?
Both.
Right, or both. Right.
Right. Let's start with the obsessive compulsive. The obsessive compulsive is you think about something, you're looking for the source of your pain. You're looking for the source. So you look at something and you say, I feel my shoulder hurts. I'm going to clean up my desk. And as long as you're cleaning up the desk, it shuts off the signal.
Mm-hmm.
So you become a desk cleaner.
That's because, see, that's when you feel the signal, as we were saying a while ago, it requires action. So if you take an action, even though cleaning up your desk may have nothing to do with your shoulder, but at least you're taking some action, and that stops that constant signaling that should not be there to begin with. So depressed people also, one of the symptoms of depression is this indescribable discomfort and pain that they feel that doctors can't medicate because it doesn't sound, from the description, it's not a legitimate kind of pain. And yet they're feeling it in the sense that they're feeling signals that they shouldn't be feeling, and they register as painful simply because that nerve should not be signaling that message.
And now you have this pain, and you go around, and no wonder you're a sourpuss. You know, there's no reason why depression should wind up in being sour. I mean, depression, let's say you're depressed and you're just hanging your head low. You shouldn't have a negative attitude, but this explains the negative attitude.
Right.
Because you're sour. You're just aching all over. You're paying
and
attention
you're
and you're looking and you're
ends.
Tired and you're looking for where's the source of this and how am I going to take care of it and what do I do next and what do I think about? Paranoia becomes a natural extension of depression as well because you're looking for the source of your pain. Who's doing it to me? Maybe if I could find it on the outside. An interesting thing about hospitals, right, Roberta? The husbands and wives who visit people in hospitals, the people who are in hospitals who have pain levels have increased pain levels when they have a sympathizing husband or wife, a concerned husband or wife.
Sure, when you have someone around you who is very solicitous in caring about your suffering, sometimes they can make it worse because they interfere with your ability to distract yourself, and they increase that signal. If someone nearby me keeps asking me, are you in pain? Are you okay? Do you need something? Are you comfortable? Are you suffering? Of course, that reminds me of the fact that I'm suffering. So it intensifies that very signal that I'm trying to distract myself from. And also, it increases my anxiety level because now, on top of the pain, I'm also worried and guilty about the fact that you're concerned about me and that you're worried about me. So now I have guilt on top of pain.
So they find that people without mates in hospitals suffer a lower level of pain.
That's right.
Which is an interesting thing. Now if you take it one step further and you think about a nasty attendant who might be coming to you in the middle of the night to take your temperature.
Mm.
You know, one wonders why when you're sleeping there in the middle of the night, I've been in the hospital a couple of times, they've got to turn on all the lights when they walk in at 4 a.m. to take your blood pressure.
Yeah, but that's kind of sadistic, actually.
Well, yeah, but you know, how does it work and why does it continue? By the very act of doing it, it gives you somebody outside of yourself to get angry at.
Mm.
And you externalize your pain.
Mm.
You get, why do you have to do that? Why do you remember that? And you feel all this. And so maybe the very act of having people in hospitals who resent the people in hospitals, you know, maybe it's part of the system that works.
Yeah, by getting
for keeping the pain reduced. You get angry and their job is to just get you angry and they don't know it. They're on automatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they walk in, but of course I'll turn on all the lights.
Mm.
You know, of course we have to turn on all the lights to take your blood pressure. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. I know we meant to take calls today, and I see we're not going to be able to do that. We're talking about depression, and from the result of what we're seeing here, depression itself will yield a higher pain level. The higher pain level, meaning the awareness of every part of your body and every signal that would normally be okay not to feel.
Right.
You know, so in other words, you're a person who is without the protection of a blocking mechanism that would see, you know, not pay attention to it.
And you know, often a depressed person will describe themselves as a raw
nerve,
which is exactly what it feels like. It feels like there's no protection, there's no numbness. And that's why also I've noticed, Armand, that people who are depressed like to go numb. They look for things that numb them, like alcohol, like cigarettes, like drugs, like things that they, so that they can finally shut off this noise that they hear from the body. Not that they hear, but it's like a sensation noise. It's an intense signaling that never stops. Finally, if they go numb, they can shut it off and rest. So this is all very interesting. And of course, maybe, Armand, we can do another show where we can talk about how a person can use their mind, you know, to, if they are in this kind of predicament, to develop new nervous pathways that can perhaps make a turnaround or make things a bit easier, because that's also part of the research that is being done, that it's indeed possible to do that.
And, you know, part of what they've come up with is they have come up with SSRIs. They have come up with ways of treating depression that seem to have been, although the horror of Prozac in this world and what's happened, the amount of it that's out there shows that there is a tremendous need. I mean, thousands and thousands of thousands of people are now taking drugs because the need is so strong, because the experience of depression is so intolerable. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to have to be going. If you want to reach Roberta, you do it at
www.creativehealthsolutions.org with the S at the end.
And do pay attention to our website, thepositivemind.com. You get a chance to... It's thepositivemind.com. You get a chance to hear all of these programs that we've done recently, as well as many from the past, thanks to Tom Gerby and Booker Irvin. It's been a good thing. Hey, email me, Armand at BrainLink, BrainLink.com. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.